So who is Sangha Achta? That's what we're going to spend a bit of time on this evening. So Sangha Achta is the man, he's an Englishman who founded the Truvana Buddhist community. That's why we're hearing about him. And it's kind of very interesting. In some senses, you could see him as being both a very traditional and a very radical person in the way, both the way he's lived his life and how he goes about things. So that might be something you can kind of, just as I'm talking, kind of be noting things, any things you want to pick out. So this is, as I say, I'm not going to go into loads of detail about any particular aspect of his life. It's more like painting a little sketch, which then, when we come to have a bit of a chance for discussion, if there's particular bits you want to know more about, or obviously if you want to find out more, as you know, books and all that about him. Well, he's written his series of memoirs, which are quite long, but also quite stimulating, quite interesting. So yeah, who is Sangha Achta? So he was born in 1925 in the East End of London. Very, very normal, very, very normal boy, you know, like his dad. I don't know what his mum and his dad did, but they did normal, boring things, you know, very, very conventional, straightforward, you know, family. So he had a fairly normal childhood growing up until the age of eight. The age of eight is the first point where, in a sense, where something quite significant happened. So he was, at the age of eight, he went to see a doctor and he got diagnosed with some kind of heart condition. And basically, this is 1933, basically he was told, if you run around and get excited, you're going to die. And was confined to bed as an 8-year-old child. He was confined to bed for a year and a half, 2 years, something like that, so quite a long time. And obviously, as an 8-year-old child, that's quite an unusual experience. What happened, the consequence of that experience, is that he was probably into reading books already, but he got massively into reading books, and, you know, he sent his mum down the library every week to get him new books and all of that. And so he's one of these, you know, genius is a sort of, well, it's a word which has quite a spin on it, so you can call him a genius or not. He's a precocious, self-taught person, basically. That's the crucial thing here. So like when he was, between the age of 8 and 10, 8 and 11, he read a really healthy canon of the world classics of philosophy and literature. So like he describes himself as an 11-year-old child. The Symposium was his favourite book. It's just like that's, and there's, in a sense, he's not saying that with, he doesn't say with that with arrogance. It's just like, what are you going to do? You're an 8-year-old kid and all you can do all day is lie in bed and read. You get into reading stuff. You know, sort of, he's quite straightforward about it in a particular, in his own way. And he particularly liked reading the children's encyclopedias, and he sort of read all of them. He read quite a substantial number of volumes of the children's encyclopedia. And he really got into literature, he really got into art, he loved looking at the pictures of all the, you know, world classics of art. And he was quite interested in religion. He describes himself around this age, because he'd read all of them. He'd read the Quran and he'd read the Bible and all this. So he sort of describes himself as hedging his bets. So he used to pray to, Vishnu, God, Allah, and the Buddha, and Jesus every night before he went to bed, because he was, he wasn't sure. So it's like, well, there's good sense in all of these things. So you say your prayers to all of them. That's respectful and appropriate. Strange tones of fate. A couple of years later, another doctor came along and said, oh, you haven't got a heart condition after all, you're fine. Get up and run along. Obviously, by this time, it had a very significant effect on how he related to the world. So he did sort of start running around again, but he's not a sporty person. He never really got into sport. He carried on being into reading and poetry and all of that. Had some friends as well. It's kind of re-engaged with the world, but he was definitely he describes himself that he's always been like very physically careful, because even after he got told that he can get up and run around, just like, you know, you've been told if you get excited you're going to die, so it has a very particular effect on your how you move around in the world. Anyway, so gets on with being a kid. By the age of 16, he has his next kind of significant experience, in a sense. He loves second-hand bookshops, and he's off browsing around a bookshop somewhere. Toby knows what's going to come in next. And he comes across two very famous Buddhist teachings, the Diamond Sutra and the Sutra of Huineng. And he describes reading these texts, he has a very, very, for him, a very significant experience. He reads these books, and he has one of those, I don't know if you've ever had that, one of those moments where you're just reading something and it kind of like, you know, like the, it just all makes sense and the world opens up and you kind of like, feels like you've been hit by a bolt of lightning. You're just like, oh yes. So he just describes reading this text as, he talks about reading it and him understanding it, and he's always understood it and he's always known what's being said, and he realises that not only is he a Buddhist, but he's always been a Buddhist. It's worth saying that the Diamond Sutra particularly is a very esoteric, paradoxical Buddhist teaching, so it's not straightforward, so for anyone to feel like they've understood it on a deep level is quite an achievement. For a 16-year-old kid who knows basically nothing about Buddhism, it says something. It says something. We'll leave it at that. He doesn't make any claims. He just describes his experience of reading it. He doesn't say, and therefore, ... He just says, oh, I read it and I understood it and I realised I was a Buddhist and I always had been. Fair enough. Off the back of this, he starts pursuing Buddhism more actively. At this point, in the mid-1930s, well, like the late-1930s, the scope of Buddhism in the Western world is, yeah, minute. Like there's a Buddhist society in London whose like their mailing list is smaller than the number of people who we send emails to. Like, I don't know, but it's like probably 40, 50 people, and that's it in London. The number of Buddhist books published at that time would have been a couple of dozen, maybe 20, 30. So he's kind of getting into it, but there's not a lot to get into, basically. World War II starts. He's 16 in 1939, 1941. So he's kind of sent off into the countryside and all of that, evacuated. A few years later, he gets called up, and he's really pleased about this because he wants to go to India, where the Buddhist people are, and he's poor and he's working class from the East End, and poor people from the East End don't get to go to India, but soldiers might do. So he's quite excited about this. His experience of getting, he's definitely a bright kid. So he gets drawn into what's called the signalman. So he never does frontline combat duty. It's kind of drawn in. Somebody was asking me about this the other week, and so like he never actually shot anyone. And it was one of the things where I think he quite enjoyed basic training. He says he did, but there's a sort of thing where he's also a bit kind of cheeky. So one of the little stories from that time is one of the things you have to do is basic training in those days was bayonet training, where you run up to a dummy and you stab crap out of it. And he described that, and he says it became obvious to him that is a deliberate cultivation of hatred. It's a deliberate cultivation of, you know, repeatedly stabbing something, pretending it's a human being. You're deliberately cultivating a hatred and separated attitude to other beings. So he got out of it. Basically, he's just like, you know, pulled a sickie or whatever. So he's kind of, you can imagine him saying that with a slightly cheeky smile. It's kind of like, you know, he talks about, well, you can always, if you don't want to do something, you can always get out of it. Anyway, so he goes to India and Southeast Asia and travels around a bit in the signalman. Coming towards the end, so he's had a bit more exposure to Buddhism and he's kind of met Buddhist Buddhist people, and also he's of a Ramakrishna mission, which is a very progressive Hindu Ramakrishna mission, very progressive modernist Hindu. He was very impressed by people from that as well, and they were very friendly and kind to him. But anyway, it's coming towards the end of World War II, and that's going to be that and back to England. So he doesn't want to go back to England. He wants to become a real Buddhist, a proper Buddhist, whatever that means. So he decides to run away. He decides to go AWOL. So he does. He runs away from the army. And and funnily enough, actually, one of my friend's dads was in the army regiment that he was in. And this only came to light a couple of years ago. They were talking about it. And his dad remembers that all the other guys in the army were like really happy because Sangharakshita, his original name is Dennis, had been talking about wanting to do this, and they all kind of knew. And the day when they all come down and kind of sit down at breakfast and he's missing from their seat, it's like everyone's really happy. They're like, he's done it, great. He's gone off to live his dream and run away to India. They're all really pleased, which is quite, I only found that out a couple of years ago. Nobody knew that up until a couple of years ago. So he sets off on a wandering phase. He wanders around Southeast India, Southern India. Basically, just him and his mate, this guy they've met. They get some robes, they burn their passports and their papers, and they go off and wander and start being wandering, begging, religious, freelance people. Funnily enough. And he calls himself Dharma Priya, which means lover of the Dharma, lover of the truth. Funnily enough, this initial period it's very free, it's very liberating, has lots of very kind of positive sort of mystical experiences. The Buddhist people he meets are really not very helpful at all. He gets a lot more help from the Hindu people. They're much more kind and welcoming, whereas the Buddhists are kind of very either he doesn't meet very many, or he doesn't, and when he does, they're not very helpful, which is unfortunate. But he spends a lot of time reflecting deeply on, well, what is Buddhism, what is it all about? And this is something you might want to come back to. I think it's very interesting. One of the things he consistently does in this period is he consistently asks himself, what is the significance of this teaching? What does it mean? What does it mean in principle and in practice? So he sort of, he's presented with all these teachings, Buddhist teachings and other teachings, and he's constantly asking himself, well, how does this apply? What does it mean? He reflected very deeply on those questions, which kind of underpins a lot of what has become the true Rana Buddhist community, because that's one of our main approaches is to ask these principial questions. Well, what's the principle behind all of this? What's it getting at? What's the point? So he spends quite a couple of years kind of wandering around southern India, getting into lots of adventures, meeting lots of different people and having quite a lot of adventures. And all of this time, as I say, he has very little exposure to practicing Buddhists, and those he does get exposed to aren't very helpful. But over time he has this sort of growing conviction that he wants to become a monk. Traditional Buddhism very clearly delineates between lay people, which would be all of us, and monks and nuns, who are the real Buddhists. And he's even though he's kind of got no passport and he's wandering around begging for his food, he's still not a proper monk. So he's like, I want to really do it. I want to really do this. So he goes off to try and get ordained as a monk. And he goes, Buddhism is very small in India at this time, actually. There's very, very little going on. And none of them are Indian people. They're all people from Southeast Asia who are in India. So he goes up to Bodh Gaya to try and get ordained, and basically the people are rude to him. And they're sort of like, they think they're in it for the money, and they're saying like, I'm not, because if you ordain someone, you become responsible for them, for kind of like looking after them. And so people are saying, we don't want you. We don't want responsibility for you. Naff off. Understandably slightly distressing and not a very nice experience for him. And his friend starts getting really, really angry, gets very, very gets very, very angry about this, his best friend. So then they have one last chance. They're like, right, we're going to go to this one last place, and if these people don't ordain us, then we're going to go off and become, we're going to get ordained into this Ramakrishna mission and become Hindus, because they welcome us and are friendly and kind and do really good work. He was very impressed by the sort of social work dimension, the social social contribution that the Ramakrishna mission made. So anyway, so they're like, right, we're going to go there. They're in Bodh Gaya, which is where the Buddha gained enlightenment. They get knocked back, and they're going to go to Kushinara, which is where the Buddha died. And they've got this possibility and like a lead. This is now, we're in the late 1940s, so very, you know, India's very, very rough. It's very, very rural. Like, he barely looks like an Englishman anymore. He's so heavily tanned, but, you know, just very, very remote places. And so they decide to walk off. They decide to walk to this place to try and get ordained. And this, basically, that's somewhat insane. It's probably, I don't know, like 150, maybe 200 miles between Bodh Gaya and Kushinara, and they walk there, and it's May. And May in India, like, you're talking 40 degree heats, you know, going up to 50. So walking 150 miles, 200 miles in May is considered insane, basically. People, you know, that's just bonkers. You know, people who he knew genuine, like, this guy wanted to wish him well, and he wanted to wish him well because it's like, he's a genuine possibility, but I'm never going to see you again because you're going to end up dead, because that's bonkers. But if you want to do it, do it. But anyway, they walk down the road, and there's this, I'll just tell you the little scene. So they really don't know if this is going to go well. Like, obviously we're sitting here, like, obviously we know that it must have gone well because we're all here, but they really don't know. It's quite edgy. And they walk off, and he describes himself walking down this road, and he talks about there being rainbows across their path. And it's not just one rainbow, it's like rainbow after rainbow, double and triple rainbows, and a whole kind of series of them. It's kind of, if you like that sort of thing, you can get very kind of like symbolic about, quite like the image. Anyway, if they go to Kushinara, they meet a guy, he's happy to ordain them, they get ordained. Hurrah! Isn't that a nice thing? He's very happy about that. So he's very happy because he's sort of fulfilled his dream of probably about 6 years or something like that, of leading a full Buddhist life. And monastic ordination involves taking on a really quite a detailed, it's not only committing yourself to practicing Buddhism in general, but you take on a very detailed sort of, it's a very detailed lifestyle choice, you could say, using today's language. So they have 226 or so specific precepts with all kinds of things, like, you know, when you eat your food, how you sleep, where you sleep, you know, how you interact with money, how people give you food, like, I don't know very much about it, but it's very, very detailed. And he's given the name Sangharakshita at this point, and he practices all of this stuff very diligently. He initially was given the name Dharmarakshita, which means protected or protector of the Dharma. But then they realised that somebody else had the same name, and they were like, oh, that's going to get really confusing if you have two people with the same name, so call you Sangharakshita instead, kind of like as a off chance. Anyway, so he gets ordained, and actually he's just sort of left to look after himself. The guy ordained him was like, right, get on with it. And he gets sent off. He ends up going to this university where there's a Pali monk scholar who takes him under his wing and is his first proper teacher, and teaches him for a year or two, teaches him logic and Pali canon. The way he describes this guy is quite a big round guy, and he used to just, he's probably Sri Lankan, he used to just lie on his hammock kind of all day, kind of just sleeping. But what Sangharakshita says, that when he'd come to him with a specific question or something like, and he'd kind of like open one eye, Sangharakshita would say, like, you know, what does blah blah mean? Whatever it was, I've got no idea, the sorts of questions. Or like, you know, this knotty problem in formal logic, what's the story? And this guy would just kind of completely be on the case and have a very kind of comprehensive and detailed response. So he looked like a big fat lazy walrus, but actually he was really on the case and very clear. Yep. So he spent a couple of years with him, and then this guy, he'd been living at this university for years, and he was a bit fed up with it, actually. And so Sangha actually just showing up and saying, oh, I've been living as a beggar, just begging from people, and they love it. They love the fact that somebody comes around and is actually, because giving alms is a very traditional kind of pan-religious activity in India. So people really loved it, but they were doing it. So this guy, his teacher, Jagdish Kashyap, is like, oh, great, so can we go and do it? And he's like, yeah, why not? So they go off having a go at kind of living a more itinerant life. And they end up in this little hill town called Kalimpong, which is just on the Tibetan border. It's one of the classic trade routes out of Tibet. And Jagdish Kashyap, he's like Sangha actually has been ordained for like a couple of years. He's been a student of Jagdish Kashyap for a year or something at this point. And Jagdish Kashyap says, I'm going to go off and wander. You stay here and work for the good of Buddhism. Sangharakshita at this point is about 27, and he's like, alright, what the hell does that mean? But that's what he's been told to do, so I'll have a go. So he stays in this town, and Kalimpong is a very kind of mixed up town. It's like, somebody was asking me the other day, does being a monk, is it all about fitting in? And it's like, actually at this point he doesn't fit in at all. There's loads of Tibetan, Nepali, predominantly Hindu, Buddhisty, mixy people. They all, and like he's medium height, wearing English guy, wearing orange robes. He completely sticks out like a sore thumb. But he gets to know people and he makes very positive connections. And he's just a very kind of, has a very positive influence on the town. Well, that's going too far. He contributes to the life of the town and contributes to sort of, he's very keen on promoting pan-Buddhist activities and stuff like that. This is before the Chinese have gone into Tibet, so although things are kind of hotting up, and so there's a steady stream of people, of Tibetans leaving Tibet and coming through. So he meets lots of famous Tibetan teachers and increasingly comes in to sort of learn from them. And increasingly, because at this point in history, Buddhism is very, very separate. So like Sri Lankan Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, they hardly know each other, exist, or recognise the existence of each other. So him as a sort of Sri Lankan Buddhist coming into contact with Tibetans is actually quite unusual. And he becomes quite open to that and starts seeing the principles underlying all of it. So he starts sort of practising Tibetan Buddhism as well as all he's already doing, and starts, you know, meditating on archetypal Buddhist and Bodhisattva figures, all that kind of stuff. So he starts practicing other forms of Buddhism as well. And he makes some really important friends, actually. One of the most significant things that come out of this phase is, particularly with one Tibetan teacher, him realising the importance of friendship as a conduit for learning and teaching Buddhism. Buddhism classically has been very sort of like teacher-disciple, kind of like, not necessarily harshly, but it's very, you know, very kind of very hierarchical, very formalised. And these two, like he's very clear that the guy who's teaching them is a very kind of deep, wise human being. So but they're friends as well. And that's quite a new relationship for both of them, or a new experience for both of them. And actually realising that there's a real opportunity for learning and deepening through friendship. So he's doing all of this, he's sort of up in Kalimpong, kind of learning about Buddhism. He also kind of goes, because the Buddhist scene is so small at this point, he's a figure on the Buddhist scene, so he gets invited places to give talks and do this and that. So he does a bit of that, he gives some very sort of like, kind of like, very, quite prestigious kind of talks to prestigious groups of people and stuff like that, because as I say, Buddhism's still so small, there's not very many people doing it. But then there's another kind of thing which happens here, which is quite significant. One of the people he meets is a guy called Dr. Ambedkar, who's interested in Buddhism, but he's predominantly a social and political figure. He's the first law minister of India. So he's a very significant political figure. He's from what's called a Dalit background, which is untouchable background, which is don't know how much familiar you are with the caste system of India. It's a caste system is a very rigid, religiously based social division policy or attitude to life, which is very painful and difficult for those at the bottom, which is obviously millions of people, but far the highest percentage of people. This figure, Dr. Ambedkar, is from this background. He's from a very, very deprived background, but he's risen to become one of the most influential figures in Indian politics of the time. And he's interested in Buddhism as well, and him and Sangharakshita they're not friends, but they have some correspondence with each other. They have some communication with each other. Dr. Ambedkar converts to Buddhism, which is a very significant event in world Buddhist history, and subsequently, hundreds of thousands of people convert to Buddhism with him. He then dies very shortly after that, which changes the face of Buddhist history, actually. If he'd have lived, there's a whole other story in that. Anyway, he dies within weeks of his initial conversion, so the scope of the Buddhist conversion is quite limited. And Sangharakshita becomes quite a significant player in supporting these very, these illiterate, very oppressed people in their desire to, transform their lives, gain dignity and respect and a good life through practicing Buddhism when they know basically nothing about it. So he spends 14 years sort of living in Kalimpong, learning about Tibetan Buddhism, writing books, and then in the summer he'd go down, probably the winter season anyway, going down and sort of teaching these new Buddhist people, these Indian Buddhists who are seeking to transform their lives through making use of the Buddhist teachings. So he does that for quite a long time, as I say, for 14 years. And then one day he gets a letter saying, Buddhism in England needs you, can you come?